Welcome to the Moss Island Sounds Podcast, Episode 6. I'm Chris Board. We're sponsored this week and every week by Finelli Sound and Lighting, a Utica, New York production company that can help with your live sound and stage lighting needs. I've worked with a lot of sound companies. Joe Finelli is who I call when I need something, and you should too. Call him at 315-794-0706. Seriously, he knows the gear you need. He's often less expensive than the online stores where you have to guess at what you're getting. In the news, Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act was signed last week by Republican Governor Mike Pence and quickly amended this week. State legislators claim their version is substantially similar to the 1993 Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which it really isn't. For one thing, the 1993 federal law had a starting point, a clear problem it intended to solve. An Oregon Native American man lost his job in 1990 after testing positive for drugs. He used peyote as part of a religious ritual. I've tried to find a similar starting point in Indiana, a problem that needed a law, with no luck. However, several religious conservative leaders stood behind the governor when he signed the law, so there's that. And we saw what happened. An immediate and unprecedented backlash. From businesses, celebrities, ordinary people. As Andy Borowitz wrote in a humorous but true headline, Indiana governor stunned by how many people seem to have gay friends. George Stephanopoulos interviewed the governor and asked him directly several times if the new law legalized discrimination against homosexuals. Pence refused to answer. If it doesn't do that, he could have said so. Instead, Governor Pence seemed dumbfounded that people keep saying the new law does something his administration doesn't want to talk about. So they caved, although maybe not far enough. 2 days ago, the law was amended but not repealed, with language specifically protecting sexual orientation and gender identity from discrimination because of the new law. It's apparently the first time Indiana has even mentioned sexual orientation or gender identity in any law, which will turn out to be more significant than any of the original supporters of this law ever imagined. So, why did this need to be a law? Have we figured that out yet? Why the hell are businesses so intent on finding ways not to serve customers? Without customers, they go out of business. When I booked my wedding, I had to call several bakeries and photographers to find out who was available. If businesses really don't want to serve someone, I expect they can find ways to do that, but they're not going to stay open. Except Politary Joe's in Utica, a place famous for terrible service. I can't stand going there, but it's packed in the few days each week they decide to open. There are plenty of restaurants I like going to which like having me, so I go to those instead. When I hear Religious Freedom Restoration Act, I think of it as a reaffirmation of separation of church and state. As in, don't inflict your religion on me. Freedom of religion and freedom from religion are both important things.
What's going on, you guys? You look a little dead. What did you do to them?
I don't know.
I farted when I was outside. Maybe some of it followed me in.
You shart yourself again?
No, Luis, I did not shart. Thank you very much. And that happened one time, and you weren't even here yet, so.
It's still funny.
Okay, are we done? I've heard that story like 3 times today.
Yeah, it's a good story.
It is a good story.
Okay, if no one has any non-poop-related announcements, I have one. As most of you are already aware, Marcus is turning 18 and will be leaving us.
Can I have his room?
We are going to be throwing him a little party next week. Marcus, any requests?
Can I shave my head?
I was talking about food for the party.
No, I don't want food. I want to shave my head.
Okay. As long as I hold the razor.
Cool.
Brie Larson is quietly amazing in Short Term 12, my favorite film of 2013. And currently available on Netflix. Destin Daniel Cretton wrote and directed based on his experiences and his own 2008 short feature. He achieves that miracle of film, transportation to a different world, with echoes that linger in the mind and heart. Larson plays Grace, an hourly worker at a foster care facility for troubled youth. Cretton places us alongside Grace and her co-workers without explaining too much of anyone's backstory. Significantly, the residents at the facility are treated with dignity. They are not problems to be solved or stereotypes to be mined, but are presented as real people. We follow Grace through a work day and then as she visits a medical clinic and goes home afterward. We learn about her the way we learn about any new acquaintance, by spending time with her. She's great at a job that many couldn't imagine doing, with plenty of life complications on the side. She's romantically involved with Mason, a nicely self-effacing John Gallagher Jr., who doesn't understand why she keeps him at arm's length. Two kids become the focus of attention as the movie progresses. One is Marcus, played by Keith Stanfield, an African-American boy who's aging out of the program. The other's Jaden, played by Caitlin Deaver, an emotionally isolated girl who cuts herself. Writer-director Cretton never allows their storylines to drift into melodrama. He's interested in relationships. To this end, the film is quite moving. It sneaks up on you. Because of the setting, we expect bad things to happen. Some do. But the resolutions carry unexpected shades of grace. Grace is, of course, the name of Larson's character. The connection isn't accidental. Short Term 12 has a few pieces like that, a bit more on the nose than they might be. One late scene is scored too intensely. The effect is jarring in the midst of an otherwise subtle musical accompaniment. A new hire at the facility is too obviously an audience stand-in. The ending might be too upbeat, although I loved it. These are small things. This is a film about love, hope, and how those make a difference in the world.
When I was 9 or 10, I used to draw portraits of all my mom's boyfriends. And then I'd sell them to her for $10 a piece.
How many boyfriends does she have?
Enough that I was able to save up and buy one of those portable CD players with anti-shock protection.
You're old.
Whatever. Those things were cool.
Good evening. Welcome to the 24-hour musicals.
Another movie you need to look up is One Night Stand, a documentary about the 24-hour plays, which was founded and continues to be run by friends of mine. The movie was made by someone who has become a friend. I know you can buy or rent it from iTunes. Make sure you get the documentary One Night Stand, singular, not 40 years worth, and also not the Mike Figgis drama. My scariest moment in show business was stepping into the Irish Arts Center for the first time at 9:15 a.m. on Monday, December 11, 2000. I'd come to light a show that would open the following weekend, but first there was a benefit performance of the musical Merry-Go-Round, which would play that evening. I'd never done lighting in New York City. I'd never seen the show. I had no idea what equipment the theater had, and I just met the director the night before. I'd slept on his couch. A runner-up moment would be programming cues for a touring production of Annie while the show was being performed. The fever dreams of people in show business usually have something to do with being completely unprepared in front of an audience. No clothes, no lines, no cues. The fabulous documentary One Night Stand, directed by Trish Dalton and Elizabeth Sperling, concerns a company that transforms those nightmares into some kind of euphoria. You're left feeling like you've witnessed the heart and soul of the creative process itself. Like another theater documentary, Every Little Step, 2008, One Night Stand concerns the mounting of a musical. Every Little Step was about the 2006 Broadway revival of A Chorus Line. One Night Stand's distinction is in its title. In this case, the show will be cast, written, rehearsed, and performed within a single day. The 24-Hour Plays Company was founded by Tina Fallon in 1995. Every production follows the same model. At 10 p.m., the creative team gathers, and by 8 o'clock that following night, they present an original work, in this case four short musicals, in front of an audience. Prior to watching this film, my uninformed opinion about the 24-Hour Plays was that it's a gimmick. It is a gimmick, but it's a worthy one. Duke Ellington's famous line, "I don't need time, I need a deadline," has never been illustrated more winningly than it is here. Of course, Dalton and Sperling were lucky in the performers chosen for this go-round, including showstopper Cheyenne Jackson, Rachel Dratch, Richard Kind, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, among others. The directors make great use of split screen and graphics to indicate how much time is left before curtain. We see the team converge at the beginning, and we watch them introduce themselves and their items. Each actor brings a costume or prop with them. Occasionally, an actor will speak directly to an interviewer behind the camera, but mostly we observe the process as it unfolds. The early hours are congenial and frenzied, and as the night wears on, the writers bear down and in some cases flirt with despair. One vomits. As Fallon tells them, that's completely normal. The film spends most of its time with the writers and actors, but I would have enjoyed seeing more of Fallon and the technical crew. The actors return in the morning and have an incredibly short block of time to learn songs, lines, blocking, and choreography. Every stage in the process and every emotion, from hey, look at me, to I'm gonna flop, will be familiar to theater people. The beats turn out to be the same, whether over 24 hours, 3 weeks, or 2 months. The final product is on wonderful display at the climax. All four pieces are intermingled for the film, which is how we watch them come together. Some great moments occur because of dropped lines, but the real magic is in the alchemy of writing, directing, choreography, and performance. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and far better than we or they had realized during creation. The best part of my day at the Irish Arts Center was the moment the curtain closed and I realized I'd pulled it off. We get to see that moment in One Night Stand, the relief when it's over, and the longing to do it again. Along the way, we laugh and fret, and frequently we're transported. This movie gets at the heart of what show business is all about.
Hear that beeper beep, it might be 3 a.m. to your car, peeling tar, there's a brain to hem. Don't lose your cool with your 45-inch knife, it's up to you what you're gonna do, how about save a life? So you watch a lot of doctor shows, ER, Chicago Hope, and you start to think, yeah, I could do that. Nope. Don't try this at home. Don't try this at home. It takes finesse, it's an art to be real fucking smart.
We're Genius. The internet is replete with examples of two-word music criticism which reflect a certain quality of thought. That sucks. I don't think Weird Al Yankovic has ever been popular enough to inspire knee-jerk vehemence, but I've experienced plenty of knee-jerk indifference when singing his praises. He's strange, people say, or isn't that the fat guy? First, his name really is Al Yankovic, Alfred Matthew, to be exact. He graduated from high school 2 years ahead of schedule as valedictorian. He has an undergraduate degree in architecture. He's a vegan who doesn't drink, smoke, or take drugs. He's still married to his first wife and has a teen daughter he reportedly dotes on. And he plays the accordion. Weird Al Yankovic had his first Billboard number one album in 2014, Mandatory Fun. It was the first comedy album to top the charts since 1963. He also joined Michael Jackson and Madonna as the only artist with top 40 singles in every decade since the 1980s. He's written and starred in his own TV series, movie, UHF, and is the author of two children's books. Yankovic is a nice guy who cried when he learned his album was number one. Although he's legally allowed to parody the work of other artists under the fair use provision of U.S. copyright law, he always gets the original artist's permission. Nice, but not entirely selfless. Yankovic bargains with the original artist to split royalties on the parody versions. I don't have much interest in the early food-centric parodies, My Bologna, I Love Rocky Road, Eat It, etc. Likewise, I don't love the solo accordion parodies, although they point to stages in Yankovic's artistic development. He met his drummer, John Bermuda Schwartz, when he performed Another One Rides the Bus in the Dr. Demento show. Yankovic has kept the same band members for decades. The beginning of Yankovic's genius is his musical comprehension and recreation of an exact musical style on a given song. Often, as much humor is derived from the music itself as from the words. But the words are also special. Stephen Sondheim has written that a near rhyme is never as good as a perfect rhyme, something most pop songwriters who aren't Paul Simon tend to be lazy about. Yankovic almost always nails the perfect rhyme, which Sondheim says requires less processing in the brain. Essentially, it allows us to mainline Weird Al's humor. I've seen Weird Al in concert 3 times, which is second in my experience only to Bruce Springsteen. I would characterize each concert as an entertainment masterpiece. Even the lighting manages to parody the typical rock concert experience. The first time I saw him, I laughed so hard I couldn't breathe, and tears rolled down my cheeks. The following is a list of essential Weird Al tracks, which shouldn't be taken as 10 best. In some sense, they're representative, although certainly a few of them are among my favorites. My personal Weird Al's greatest playlist includes 33 tracks, and I didn't want to say that much any more than you want to hear it. Yoda. This parody tells the Star Wars Empire Strikes Back story to the tune of the Kinks' Lola. Like most Yankovic parodies, knowledge of the original is not required, but the experience is heightened if you can draw connections between
I met her in a club down in Old Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes like Coca-Cola, C-O-L-A, Cola.
And
I met him in a swamp down in Dagobah, where it bubbles all the time like a giant carbonated soda. S-O-D-A, soda.
And of course, soda is a perfect rhyme for Yoda. Later, Yankovic made a similar parody of Don McLean's American Pie, summarizing Star Wars' The Phantom Menace. George Lucas apparently loves both parodies, and Don McLean has said that he now sometimes gets the lyrics confused when he plays American Pie in concert. Yankovic frequently links both songs together in his own concerts, with his band dressed as characters from the Star Wars movies. Amish Paradise. Hip-hop artist Coolio long insisted he hadn't given Yankovic permission to record this parody of Gangsta's Paradise, although Yankovic says Coolio's representatives had signed off on the idea. Coolio now says he was wrong and finds the song actually funny as shit. He's received royalties from Yankovic's version, and younger fans sometimes think he's covered Yankovic instead of vice versa. Regardless, the concept itself is hilarious, applying the attitude of modern street gangsters to a hypothetical young Amish man.
As I walk through the valley where I harvest my grain, I take a look at my wife and realize she's very plain. But that's just perfect for an Amish like me. You know I shun fancy things like electricity.
Yankovic is also known as a respectable rapper. Original artist Chamillionaire commented about Yankovic's hit song White and Nerdy. He's actually rapping pretty good on it. It's crazy. I didn't know he could rap like that. It's really an honor when he does that. Your horoscope for today. A style parody, not taken from a particular song, but done in a particular style. In this case, third wave ska, characterized by dominating guitar riffs and large horn sections. The best Weird Al songs send up not only their musical inspiration, I'd argue they honor it, but also skewer a specific target mercilessly.
You will never find true happiness. What you gonna do? Cry about it. The stars predict tomorrow you'll wake up to a bunch of stuff and then go back to sleep. That's your horoscope for today. That's your horoscope for today.
And The Amazing Bridge, which says what most people probably think but are too polite to say.
Now you may find it inconceivable, or at the very least a bit unlikely, that the relative position of the planets and the stars could have a special deep significance, our meaning that exclusively applies to only you. But let me give you my assurance that these forecasts and predictions are all based on solid scientific documented evidence. So you would have to be some kind of moron not to realize that every single one of them is absolutely true. Where was
For me, one of the funniest musical moments in a Weird Al song occurs in the final verse about Capricorns. I'm not sure why it's so funny.
You would lock my doors and windows and never leave my house again.
He inserts an extra beat before the word house, and at first glance you might wonder why he didn't work a little harder on the meter of the line. That's where I always convulse with laughter. The extra beat is what's funny, for some reason. It's even funnier in concert, with every band member on the exact same wavelength. My baby's in love with Eddie Vedder. Style parody of the Zydeco genre. Pauline Kael wrote that Steve Martin's act was a parody of a certain kind of comedian. Likewise, Weird Al's meta-humor is among his richest, when he makes fun of himself as an accordion-playing pop star. In this case, his groupie girlfriend has decided she prefers Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder to Yankovic, which is funny because it's so reasonable. But Yankovic insists on cataloging their differences over an accordion-inflected backing track.
Now every time I see him, well, he looks so grim. A rock star like him. What a pain in the butt to have so much success. Spending all his time moping and avoiding the press. But my girl can't get enough of his sullen demeanor. Like he's some big torture genius and I'm some kind of wiener. While my baby's in love with an Eddie Vedder, she's got a thing for that Eddie Vedder. Tell me what can he do that I can't.
The self-deprecating lyrics are brilliant and deliver a climax that might be lost in future generations if they forget who Alanis Morissette was. Smells Like Nirvana. In the early 1990s, Weird Al might have disappeared entirely if not for this parody, which he regards as his first satirical song. Michael Jackson, a Yankovic fan who'd provided two of Weird Al's biggest hits, Eat It and Fat, asked Al not to parody his song Black or White as Snack All Night. When Al asked Kurt Cobain if he could parody Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, Cobain's only condition was that it couldn't be about food. Instead, Yankovic's song was about how nobody could understand the lyrics to Nirvana's songs. Cobain subsequently characterized Yankovic as a musical genius. And Nirvana drummer Dave Grohl later said that Yankovic's song was when he knew the band had made it.
Now I'm mumbling, and I'm screaming, and I don't know what I'm singing. Crank the volume, ears are bleeding. I still don't know what I'm singing. We're so loud and...
Yankovic performs the song live in a blonde wig and practically channels Cobain as he thrashes and flops around the stage. It's valediction, mockery, parody, and tribute. It's also hilarious. One more minute. Weird Al Yankovic has cited Mad Magazine as one of his main influences, which is obvious. He sometimes leans too much in the teen boy fart joke direction. But the line between potty and sublime is not always distinct. The song might be one of the best examples of that. This song is an Elvis Presley-style parody, with a jilted lover singing about all the things he'd rather be doing than spending one more minute with his ex-lover. There is no better example of the Weird Al fine line than this.
I guess I might seem kind of bitter. You got me feeling down in the dumps. 'Cause I'm stranded all alone in the gas station of love, and I have to use the self-service pumps. Oh,
if you find that line brilliant, keep listening. Truck Driving Song. Absolutely the most single-minded of Weird Al's one-joke songs. It's sung in the style of a Johnny Cash country song from the point of view of a cheerfully cross-dressing trucker. That's the whole joke. But it keeps getting funnier as it goes along. The big bass voice distressed because
when I hit those big speed bumps, my darling little rhinestone bumps keep slipping off the mother love and clutch. But still,
this is the song my family is most likely to sing along with on a road trip.
The interstate just trying to make a buck. Wearing feather boas with sequins and chiffon while I'm driving a truck with my high heels on.
The Night Santa Went Crazy, a style parody of Soul Asylum's Black Gold. I co-wrote a song like this once, contrasting the idyllic acoustic folk guitar with hard rock. I also wrote a weak parody of Yankovic's Buckingham Blues that I called Rich Suburban Kid Blues. I performed it in my underwear a la Tom Cruise in Risky Business. This is the second Christmas-themed song Yankovic released after Christmas at Ground Zero. Like that one, it's not the most reverent Christmas song.
Down in the workshop, all the elves are making toys for the good Gentile girls and the good Gentile boys. When the boss busted in, nearly scared him half to death. Had a rifle in his hands and cheap whiskey on his breath. From his beard to his boots, he was covered with ammo. Like a big, fat, drunk, disgruntled Yuletide Rambo. And he smiled as he said, with a twinkle in his eye, Merry Christmas to all, now you're all gonna die. The night Santa went crazy, the night Saint Nick went crazy.
Okay, so there's one near rhyme in there, ammo, Rambo. But if you're not tickled once the jingle bells turn into heavy metal guitars, this song's not for you anyway. The Biggest Ball of Twine in Minnesota. A story song in the style of Harry Chapin and Gordon Lightfoot. It's almost 7 minutes and 1,000 words long, and to me represents Yankovic at his most generous. A small-time HVAC contractor takes his family on a dream vacation to the titular attraction. Along the way, Yankovic affectionately celebrates Americana in all of its ridiculousness.
Like Elvis Orama, the Tupperware Museum, the Boll Weevil Monument in Cranberry World, the Shuffleboard Hall of Fame, Poodle Dog Rock, and the Mecca of Albino Squirrels. We've been to Ghost Town, Steam Parks, Wax Museums, and a place where you can drive through the middle of a tree scene, alligator farms and tarantula ranches, but there's still one thing we gotta see.
Rather than being disappointed when they finally get there, the family can't wait to go back again. And Weird Al finds a way to make a perfect rhyme out of "I can't think of anywhere else I'd rather go to than the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota." Perfect indeed. Albuquerque. Yankovic started including long-form parodies in his 1999 album Running with Scissors. Albuquerque is 11 minutes, 22 seconds long, and was originally thought of by its creator as something that people might listen to once, if at all. It's a song in the tradition of George Thorogood.
But then one fateful night, Zelda said to me, she said, "Sweetie Pumpkin, do you want to join the Columbia Record Club?" I said, "Whoa! Hold on now, baby! I'm just not ready for that kind of a commitment!" So we broke up and I never saw her again, but that's just the way things go. In Albuquerque. Albuquerque.
The song has become one of Yankovic's most beloved. I saw him perform it live in 2011, surely one of the highlights of my concert-going life. Subsequent long song album enders have included the Frank Zappa-inspired Genius in France, 2003, Trapped in the Drive-Thru, 2006, and Jackson Park Express, 2014. Albuquerque is the best, not just because the name of the real place begins with the letters L. Of course, this list is incomplete and might provoke some griping. Please feel free to let me know. I realize I haven't mentioned Don't Download This Song, a parody of We Are the World style benefits, in this case for artists struggling because of illegal music downloads. Yankovic offered the song as a free download on his website. Or his pitch-perfect Talking Heads parody Dog Eat Dog. Or Close But No Cigar.
Yeah, she was so pretty, she made Charlize Theron look like a big, fat, slobbering pig. The only caveat is one of her earlobes was just a little tiny.
Or stop forwarding that crap to me.
By the way, your quotes from George Carlin aren't really George Carlin. Mr. Rogers never fought the Viet Cong. And Bill Gates is never gonna give me something for nothing. And I highly doubt some dead girl's gonna kill me if I don't pass her letter along. Well, now I know you're...
Weird Al's like that. Weird and funny as hell. Genius? Maybe.
I'm nerdy, indie, extreme, and whiter than sour cream.
I was in AV club and glee club and even the chess team. Only question I ever thought was hard. What, do I like Kirk or do I like Picard?
Spend every weekend at the Renaissance Fair. Got my name on my underwear.
They see me strolling, they laughing, and rolling their eyes because I'm so white and nerdy.
Just because I'm white and nerdy.
Just because I'm white and nerdy.
All because I'm white and nerdy.
Once upon a time, there was nothing in the world but a little boy and his Oreo cookies. Rich and chocolatey outside, smooth and creamy inside. And that was enough. Then, the little boy wanted something to have with his Oreo cookies. So, there was milk. And then, something to keep the milk in, a cow. And a farm to keep the cow on. And then, houses sprang up and cities and, well, you know the rest. A lot can happen with Oreo cream sandwich, baked by Nabisco.
Someday, if I own a bed and breakfast in some little New England town, I will offer a dessert item consisting of a stack of Oreo cookies and milk. The first, but not the most crucial question is, regular or double stuff? It goes without saying that the Oreos must be chocolate with white filling, traditional style. But the question of how much filling is trickier. If there were no such thing as milk, it would be easy. Double stuff, hands down. If all dunked Oreos took milk consistently, then regular would be fine. The confounding thing about Oreos, and one of the most interesting things about them actually, is that there are many subtle variations in the density of the chocolate cookie that combine to impact the amount of filling one might want in any given bite. The ideal solution would be somewhere between the single and double, but of course that would be a custom job. Let's put this issue on the shelf for now. The second choice is, what kind of milk is best? It has to be cold milk, but not so cold that the tips of your fingers freeze when you dunk. I could offer a choice, but my customers might want a recommendation from an expert. Skim milk is little more than murky water. What's the point? Whole milk is too rich. Note a similar problem with root beer floats. The very best ice cream and the very best root beer combined don't make the best root beer float because the combination is too much. So I'd go with an ice cold 2%. 8 ounces in a wide mouth cup is best. If the cup isn't wide enough, one can't dunk effectively. If it's too deep, one risks losing a cookie, and if it's too shallow, the entire Oreo can't be submerged. Dunking Oreos is a primal pleasure and an art. Fingers must be clean. One should never mix hands. Keep the same dunking hand until finished. Grasp the Oreo between the thumb and the first two fingers. Keeping the cookie vertical, quickly dunk the entire cookie in the milk, releasing on the downstroke. The cookie should gently touch the bottom of the glass and return to one's grasp. Next, various advanced techniques can be added. The spinning wheel, rotate the cookie in the milk like a wagon wheel. The new moon, let the cookie lie flat in the milk, flip with a quick downstroke of the index finger to allow both sides equal coverage. And the dribble, wherein the cookie is bounced repeatedly off the bottom of the glass. Now, how long does one dunk an Oreo? There's much controversy among the uninitiated, but little debate between Oreo purists, as long as it takes. The perfectly dunked Oreo will begin to sink in the milk. At that precise moment, the Oreo should be removed from the milk and eaten in one bite. The very best Oreos will show a telltale pattern of bubbles that taper off as the cookie becomes properly saturated. Be careful not to perform a new moon on a perfect Oreo. As likely as not, it will be lost to the bottom of the glass. Strangely, the very best Oreos only happen every fifth or sixth cookie. The ratio seems to be 1 to 5.5 in a package. It is the anticipation and hope for these gems that Oreo connoisseurs keep eating for. Still, Oreos and milk are much like sex, and some would say pizza, although I'm not sure about that. Even when they're not great, they're still pretty good. It should be mentioned that Oreo is not a generic term. The cookie must say Oreo. Hydrox and other store brand knockoffs are inferior and should be avoided at all costs. How many Oreos is too many? The funny thing is that they all taste great until the very last one. You're not aware you're going too far until you've gone. Experience should dictate how many is enough. After a full meal, 4 might be satisfying, but the average for Oreo lovers seems to be 6. In my restaurant, I will offer 7. No doggy bags. Oreos don't last long in the wild, and Ziploc bags give them an unpleasant plastic flavor. When the last cookie is dunked, wipe fingers on a napkin. Drink the milk in a long yet civilized draft. This is the crown of the dessert. Wipe corners of the mouth with a napkin. Digest.
Oh, 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 ice cold milk and an Oreo cookie. They forever go together, what a classic combination. When a dark, delicious cookie meets an icy cold sensation, like the one and only creamy, crunchy chocolate Oreo.
Well, if I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening. All over this land,
over this land.
I'd hammer out danger,
danger.
I'd hammer out a warning,
warning.
I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters, all over this land.
You can find more essays and criticism at mossislandsounds.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter as Moss Island, all one word. Email me at chris.board@mac.com. Thank you for listening. Until next time. The original writing from the Moss Island Sounds podcast is owned by Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds, copyright 2015. Unauthorized use and or duplication of this material without express and written permission from Chris Board is strictly prohibited. Excerpts and links may be used, provided that full and clear credit is given to Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds, with appropriate and specific direction to the original content.
I'd sing out a warning,
warning.
I'd sing out love between my brothers and my sisters. Oh.